This is Mark Steiner, and as you know, we've been covering the trial of George Zimmerman with some intensity and focus here, as we will continue. There was a piece that was in the New Yorker on their website that was brought to our attention by Dr. Ray Wimbush. It was written by a man who's been on the show before, Dr. Jelani Cobb, who's Associate Professor of History and Director of the Institute for African American Studies at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. He's author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, To Break the Dawn of Freestyle and Hip-Hop on the Hip-Hop Aesthetic, and Devil and Dave Chappelle and Other Essays. And he's got a new book coming out entitled Antidote to Revolution, African-American Anti-Communism and the Struggle for Civil Rights, 1931 to 1957. And Jelani Cobb, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Jelani, the piece you wrote was for The New Yorker was Rachel Gentel, on trial, and it's your kind of take on how this woman was received by the white world at large and by people in that courtroom, and because of what she represents. Talk a bit about that.
Well, you know, what was interesting about the trial, during the time when Ms. Gentel was testifying, was that there seemed to be, the subcurrent. And at some point, it was so glaring that it was hard to even think of it as a subcurrent. But there was this theme of not only, the credibility of her testimony, which the defense would reasonably, attack, this is their job, but it seemed to be almost an implicit indictment of her. And by that, there was a consistent, references to, asking her to repeat herself, to the defense attorney appearing to be befuddled by what she was saying. Now, these are people who are practicing law in this, this area. These are people who have dealt with people. The legal system is democratic in this way, and that you wind up encountering lots of different kinds of people. Surely he had spoken to someone who had cross-examined or defended someone who spoke in her particular vernacular. But then, asking her to read back the transcript and then, confronting her on the issue of whether or not she had someone write, assist her in writing a letter to Sabina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother. And what it ultimately seemed to do was shrewdly, in some way, play on class, race, gender, stereotypes, even kind of the idea of her as being a substantially sized woman, young woman. And it all came together in this kind of cocktail of stereotype. And that's what I was reading, in this. And I didn't think that black people were immune from it either. I saw some really vicious things written, about her from blacks and whites. And I thought there were very many African Americans who were embarrassed by her diction and the idea that she might appear to represent a stereotype. And so that was what, made me decide to write the piece.
I mean, it reminds me of something that you wrote, just one line of the many things you wrote in this short piece for The New Yorker, where you wrote, her time on the stand seemed to be like a scene wisely cut out of the movie Precious.
Yes. It really seemed like that. The movie Precious, for people who haven't seen it, it's about a young woman, who is overweight, who has, literacy problems, and who is really kind of pursuing this path, trying to find, dignity and a place where she's respected and valued as a human being. And so that is, it just seemed like that scene was cut, was something that would be cut from that movie. And it echoed so cleanly, the themes that were, would be, explored in the film.
Well, I mean, one of the things that when you look at the commentary around her testimony, first, before we go back to the court for a moment, we look at the commentary, I'm thinking about the things you just said, what you described. On the one hand, for many white Americans, she fits the stereotype of someone not too bright, not very aware, not inarticulate, etc.
Mm-hmm.
All those stereotypes and more. On the other hand, you also talked about what I would consider maybe some of the African-American middle class looking at her going, she's an embarrassment.
Right.
Right.
And, what I said previously in discussing it was that, this is a trial that centers on the question of racial profiling, and somehow or another, during her testimony, it went from a trial about racial testimony to a workshop in how it's conducted. Because that seemed to be exactly whether or not people could look past the profile and listen to what Rachel Jontel was saying about the last moments of Trayvon Martin's life, you know, was the question on everyone's mind.
Yeah, so I wonder how, in the context of she's not on the stand anymore. It's interesting that, as you pointed out, is that the defense, I keep calling Zimmerman's defense the prosecution, but the defense in this case kind of pointing out that she spoke three languages, as if defending her intelligence, as you put it, having to do that.
When the prosecutor got up and he started questioning her about her background, and it came out that she's her mother is Haitian and does not speak any English, and but she has other familial relations that are from the Dominican Republic and speak Spanish, and so she communicates with her relatives in Spanish and in Haitian Creole as well as English, and so there was kind of an implied point in that, and the prosecution brought that up. And the implication was that he was defending her from the kind of insults about her intelligence. They were aware, I'm sure, of what was going on social media. They were probably aware that, you know, perhaps people in the jury were thinking those same kinds of ways. And saying, regardless of whatever else, this is also a person who speaks three languages. She is not stupid, and that, you know, she knows what she heard and what the conversation, the content of the conversation with Trayvon Martin was.
So I'm curious, what is Jelani Cobb? What's your analysis of both the person that you know do not know, Rachel Jontel and testimony, and what that would mean for this trial? What do you think all this sums? How do you sum that up?
It's very hard to say. I'll be honest with you. What I do think, and I think, you know, these are things I put in the piece too, is that, you know, there's some things about her that are very clear. One, that she was very deeply hurt by the loss of her friend. Another, that she continued to grapple with that. You know, the third was that, you know, people excoriated her for being a reluctant witness and sometimes being antagonistic towards the defense. But I saw that antagonism as a defense mechanism of her own, because she walked into a room where she absolutely knew that people had assessed her and dismissed her with a glance. And I'm sure this wasn't the first environment that she's experienced something like that. We know how these things operate in this country. And so she had every reason to be reluctant about the proceedings. And so what the jury will make of that, five white women and, you know, one other woman who is, I believe, Hispanic, it's very difficult to assess. I can't kind of look into a crystal ball about this. But I thought that whether intentionally or not, she gave the example of exactly what Trayvon Martin encountered that night when George Zimmerman saw him and started saying, you know, these curse word punks, they always get away.
And where we are now with this trial, I'm curious your observations of where we are. Just, and it's not in your piece, in your article, I know you're watching this closely. And many people, especially people who think that Zimmerman is guilty, especially people in the African-American community, and not just the African-American community, find what he says to be incredulous at best, and that we're talking about the murder of a young teenager by an adult. But I'm wondering how you're seeing how this is playing out. What's your analysis of what's going on there now?
I mean, it's really... you know, it's really kind of anyone's guess. So, you know, what we've seen in the last couple of days has been, you know, the former lead prosecutor, Chris Delino, on the stand. And they've been trying to, you know, make the argument that that George Zimmerman was not racially profiling Trayvon Martin. They've been trying to, you know, kind of go through the big point about there allegedly being video and whether or not, you know, George Zimmerman thought that the video would be exculpatory. And then, you know, of course, the prosecution talking, you know, about the fact that George Zimmerman may have been aware that the prosecution, that the detective was bluffing him about the existence of video. And, you know, it's really kind of drilling down into the minutiae of this case. The other thing that, you know, I think was important that came out yesterday was that in his, statement, Zimmerman says that he is not pursuing Trayvon Martin after the dispatcher told him not to. He says he's simply gotten out of the car to determine the name of the street that he was on. And, you know, it seems highly improbable, you know, if there are only three main streets in this subdivision and Mr. Zimmerman was the head of the neighborhood watch, then it would seem reasonable that he would know the name of the street.
Right. One would think.
Yes.
The other part, one of the things that before we conclude, that we'll see how this plays out over the coming weeks, but that Serino, who is the detective who actually wanted to see Zimmerman charged with manslaughter and did make the charge of manslaughter, also said apparently today that that Zimmerman was telling the truth. He believed that Zimmerman was saying he was not following him because he was black. He also said that the medical examiner's report supported his claim that Trayvon was on top of him when Zimmerman shot him, and also agreed that it was looking bad that Zimmerman called people a-holes and effing punks after he saw Trayvon, that how it could be departed, could be kind of seen as spiteful and hateful. But that kind of mixed testimony, is playing in some ways, some people fear, to whether or not Zimmerman committed second-degree murder in the eyes of that jury.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that was very important, and Al Sharpton brought this up last night, one of the things that was very important in this was that he raised the point that Chris Serino has a motive for saying he did not think that George Zimmerman was racially profiling Trayvon Martin, because then it raises the question yet again of why the police made the decision to let George Zimmerman go home. Why was he not arrested? Why did it require 40 some odd days and the creation of a special prosecutor for him to be arrested? And so I think I don't want to say that the detective was being dishonest, but I do think that's something that we should be considering when we look at the testimony.
Well, Dr. Lonnie Cobb, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward very much to seeing what you think as this trial goes on and our future conversations, as well as looking forward to your new book when it comes out. Lonnie Cobb, of course, Assistant Professor of History and Director of the Institute for African American Studies at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. Lonnie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of the movement to desegregate Gwin Oak Park. A huge celebration is taking place in July. We'll talk with some of the civil rights warriors who were there and others. And you're going to hear an interview I did with the late, great historian Howard Zinn.